format of a workshop, this gathering. And Honorable Chohel will obviously lead in that. The main purpose was really to assist the chairpersons in dealing with legislation in particular. And then the mechanisms, you know, that are, and then the rules and applications of the rules that are existing in the institution in consideration of the legislation, from tagging, referral tagging, and all those particular issues. Based on a number of chairpersons who are new, not new in a sense that after a year we'll still regard you as new, no, not at all. but obviously knew that there will be quite a number of legislation coming your way. When we started in May last year, there were only 3 pieces of legislation. Up to March this year, there were still about 6. But the volume is now increasing. We are sitting with about 29 to 30 legislation, pieces of legislation, and the volume is going up now. And very soon we'll be caught up in situations of not understanding certain particular elements. And I think the workshop for the chairperson was mainly meant for that. We also have a number of apologies, I must say. 24 apologies. Chairpersons, 24 of them say they will not be able to come. All have reasons. Those who are NEC members, unfortunately, there's a special NEC today. At the time when we postponed the meeting, obviously, that was not part of the knowledge on our side that there will be a special NEC meeting. So we're sitting today and finishing today. So all those who are in the NEC have left for the meeting of the NEC. And then others is reasons of illness, and then others is because they are chairing portfolio committees that are considering legislation, and there's a deadline of the 17th of September for them to conclude on that particular piece of legislation. And one of them who's affected is Mr. Martins here, who will have to go earlier and go and share that meeting at 9:30. He tried to start with us at 9 so that he could then respect, but unfortunately he has to leave now to go and share because he's got people who are coming to give evidence before the portfolio committee in relation to that particular legislation. So all those who are dealing with legislation obviously are excused to really go and finish that work, because on the 17th they ought to conclude so that the pieces of legislation can be processed in the NA, and then they go to the NCOP. Cycle. There are cycles, as you know. I think, yeah. So then those are a variety of apologies. So we decided that we'll continue with the chairs that are here, those who are here, and but we'll still develop a mechanism of maybe a midweek type of a workshop in the evening, because in that way I think we'll be able to get everybody to provide all the necessary resources for that particular. In that way we can reach a number of chairpersons. But because we have experts that have been invited to Mr. Mayor, he is a doctor now or professor. he has to leave at 10:30. So we just have really to respect his coming and but I'll leave the workshop running to Ms. Chohen. He's the one who is going to do the facilitation. Mine was just to welcome me. I'll be sitting there also learning, because some procedural aspects are also beginning to confront us from the office of the chairperson and the speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And may I just say and congratulate you on this initiative, because I do think it's absolutely necessary that we, as chairperson, start engaging on some of these issues sooner rather than later. And the earlier we start in the term of Parliament, I think the better it bodes for us to actually, in our day-to-day practice, deal with some of these issues appropriately. May I just, on the issue of process, seeing as many of the chairs here actually, this will be a kind of refresher course as opposed to something new. I look at Mr. Sagoni, Mr. Martin, Mr. Burgess, even people have been exposed to these procedures in practice. The idea was really to particularly focus on people who are new chairs, so that we don't traverse the same problem areas that we had in previous parliaments and so on. And so maybe what we can do today is to run the thing with the small group that we have and try and finish as soon as possible, because a lot of people need to leave. But certainly by 10:30 we should be done. But then we still do that other session, as you say, perhaps on a weeknight, and try and get as many chairs there as possible. We're very, very fortunate, and maybe I must ask Mr. Mayor, are you comfortable there, Anton, or do you want to come over here? I think it's better for you to come over here, given that we're such a small group. We're very fortunate to have had... Anton, those of you who know Anton Meyer, he used to be in Parliament, and I can't remember what title you had. There was a chief legal advisor. I must say it's been an absolute learning experience for me as well, working with Anton. And so we are extremely fortunate to have him with us, really as a resource to actually draw from. Thank you. What I want to suggest is, firstly, colleagues, you would have had this document for a while, and those of you who haven't had an opportunity to read it, it's not a train smash. What we will do is we'll try and go through some of the key aspects quite slowly, and we'll try and draw out those aspects that we feel would have practical implications for yourselves as chairperson. But just to contextualize this document for you so that we don't misunderstand each other, this document arises from a task team that was set up in the previous parliament. As parliament has matured and as our legislative process has matured and as our interactions with the other branches of government as those things have evolved, we encountered a few snags in the legislative process. So let's recap. In 1994, when we started this institution, we had these wonderful notions of this parliament is going to be an open parliament, as opposed to the previous parliament that we had in this country. And much of the design of this institution and the practices that continued as we became a new democracy, then got concretized into what the court would regard as part of the law of the procedure when it comes to passing legislation. Now, remember, when somebody wants to attack a piece of legislation, they do it on two grounds. The first is the process through which it was adopted. And that is very key to the work that we are busy doing now. The second would be the substance contained in that legislation, to see whether it is constitutional or not constitutional and so on. So what has happened over that period was that we had run into a few difficulties on some of these issues that we're going to be tackling today. And the previous speaker felt that, no, it wasn't the previous speaker, it was the speaker before Gwen. It was a speaker Mbete who had convened this task team. And the mandate of the task team was essentially to look at these various issues that gave us difficulties. And to look at what the courts were saying was the law, to look at our practice and to really now start asserting ourselves as parliament. Because what had happened was that we had left things gaping and we said, well, you know, these are practices and they'll evolve into practices and so on. But when people started challenging particularly the proceedings of certain bills and so on, in their judgment, the Constitutional Court actually started concretizing and telling Parliament what the law was, when in fact the intention of the Constitution is very clear that it is Parliament's business to arrange its internal affairs. But because there were no arrangements on these things, the courts then usurped those places. So it was felt very importantly that Parliament needed to deal with these problems because they were quite vexed, but that it was a terrain for Parliament to pronounce itself and not the courts. And so for that reason, this task team was established. Now, as part of the task team, as I said, we were very fortunate to have Mr. Mayor coming in to assist us with some drafting and with some advice and so on. But as far as members were concerned, from certainly the ANC, it was, if I recall, myself as convener, Mr. John Jeffrey over there, Comrade Plantlan Nene. From the opposition, I think it was Kosana Merva, Mr. Joubert, and basically it was a bunch of lawyers, and the NCOP as well had representation on the staff team. And you'll find that the document in one sense is drafted quite legalistically. Why? Because in fact, a lot of what we're suggesting and recommending has to be set out in legalese, as it were, in the rules. We're making very substantive recommendations in some regards with regard to the rules of Parliament and the joint rules and so on. So you'll find that this is not necessarily a politically infused document. It's really just saying very sort of clinically, this is the situation, this is what we think needs to be refined, out of discussions that were in fact political. So prior to the staff team, there were a whole host of workshops with MPs from all parties, and people were discussing this. But obviously, as workshops go, these things then tend to hang in the air. Nobody actually takes things forward. So it was really the staff team's job to take those discussions forward, work from the reports of these various workshops, and try and pull something together that actually made sense in terms of saying these are the rules that need to change, and this is why we're recommending that certain things have to be done in a certain way because of certain court judgments, etc., etc. I'm also mindful that oftentimes when we speak, we tend to speak past our audience because of the fact that this thing is drafted in a very clinical way. I'm reminded of a time when I was not so long ago speaking to a bunch of school kids and explaining to them what our constitution is and what are the various institutions that make up our system of government. And I said to them that the Constitutional Court tells us in Parliament when things that we do are unconstitutional. And I saw the sea of just blank faces, and one bright little fellow said, "Oh, you mean they tell you when it's not Ayoba?" I said, "Okay, that's what." And so now, instead of saying unconstitutional, I say not Ayoba. So please, if there are things that we're saying here that you're not entirely sure what we mean and so on, please feel free. I think we're a small enough group for people to just pick up their hands and say, "Look, you know, can you explain this, that, and the other?" What we're going to do is we're going to alternate between the topics. Mr. Mayor is going to begin with the legislative process, which is the first part of this document. We are going to skip a few sections in this document simply because we don't think it's necessarily arenas that you would necessarily get involved in, because remember, this document was drafted for the Joint Rules Committee. But we have picked out the things that we think, particularly for new chairs, it's quite important for you to know. So it's the legislative process that we're going to deal with and the stages. We're going to skip the next one, and we're going to go to the committee procedure. Then we're going to do the tagging, which is another big area of contention. And then the public participation process, and then the legislative handbook. So that's really those are the issues that we'll try and pull out for you. Of course, if there are issues that you want to raise with us at some stage on these other matters, feel free to communicate with either myself or Anton, perhaps after the workshop and so on. So unless there are any questions of clarity as to how we're going to proceed, I suggest that I hand over to Anton. I've already spoken, I think, far too long. Thanks.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Joanne, thank you very much, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen, members. Firstly, I want to say thank you very much for the invitation. It's always good to be back here in the old ground, and I see there's been some renovations around, also many new faces that I don't know. But thank you very much for the invitation of getting me back here. Yes, when we prepared this document, we started more than 2 years ago, and many things have changed in the meantime. Part of it, the new faces, of course, but there has been some development, and especially as far as the tagging of bills is concerned, but we'll get to that later, where there has been a judgment of the Constitutional Court which will require considerable rewriting, certainly of that part of the report. We had a look firstly at the legislative process, and what we wrote here would basically be old news for those who are used to these things, but we thought that it would be a good thing to just start by setting out the legislative process as it sort of normally unfolds, and from there then take it forward, maybe make a few recommendations about that. The Constitution provides for bills to be introduced by any member in the National Assembly, any committee, and any member of the executive, only in the National Assembly, of course. But in practice, with very few exceptions, all bills are introduced by the executive. And so the stages that we show here really refer to the bills emanating from the executive. Yes, we are there at the point, the initiating and development and cabinet approval. That is usually the first step. Obviously, there could be various reasons why bills are conceived and legislation, why it is thought necessary. Bearing in mind, of course, that ultimately, there is only really one purpose of new legislation, and that is to change the law, as it stands. Because whether it's an amendment bill or a new bill, the idea is to change the law as it stands, and obviously that's a very important part of what should be done in a bill, to explain fully how that is what the legal position should be. So usually a first draft is prepared. In many other countries that isn't done, but in South Africa that is the usual process that the department or whatever consultants they may use, departmental specialists, prepare a first draft, and then that is sent to cabinet for approval in principle. And then at the second point, submission of the draft bill to parliament, we have the rule, joint rule 159, which requires that as soon as Parliament has approved the legislative proposals, then the draft of the bill must be sent to Parliament together with a memorandum explaining the objects. That envisages a procedure long before the bill itself is introduced, and the purpose being to assist the committees, because that bill is then referred by the Speaker and the NCOP chairperson to the respective committees that would be dealing with the bill later on. And the purpose is to assist those committees to acquaint themselves with the subject of the bill in the meantime, and also for planning purposes. But as we say there in the note, that in practice, this rule is not working as it should, with the result that its purpose is lost. I've just heard of a bill, I think Mr. Bell told us, where a bill is being introduced now, and the Section 159 notice was never received. Parliament often does not receive the draft bill before it's submitted for introduction. Then we also think that at that stage, it's really just for notification for planning purposes and so on, it doesn't really serve a purpose to send the whole bill to Parliament. And I think from a practical point of view also that it's not really needed, because quite often that bill is considerably changed in the process, and to have not a fully thought through bill before the committee in public there might not always be advisable. So that's why we say that a long title or a summary of the bill might be sufficient at this stage, and we make a recommendation further on. Then the third stage is the processing and certification by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. They must fit it into a proper draft bill for certification. There is a rule in the NA rules that requires any bill introduced to first be certified by a state law advisor as being consistent with the constitution, etc., and properly drafted. The NCOP does not have an equivalent rule, but that certification by the Chief State Law Advisor or the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor is a requirement. And then after the State Law Advisors have certified the bill, then it is submitted to Parliament's Bills Office. Mr. Bell is there. It used to be the Legislation and Proceedings section for editing, publishing and proofreading, which could be quite a lengthy process, of course, depending on the subject matter. The next stage, or really simultaneously there, is the question of prior notice and publication of the draft. That is not the publication by Parliament, by the person or the minister introducing the bill. In the Government Gazette, notice must be given and explanatory memorandum of the bill, or the bill as it is to be published, must be published in the Gazette. The NCOP rule requires that at this stage there should be a notice inviting interested persons to submit representations to the Secretary to Parliament. The NA rules require such an invitation only when the bill as it is to be introduced is to be published, but we say there that the time period between the publication and the introduction itself might be too short for comments received after that publication to be taken into account, but I think that might not really be the idea, because the purpose of the publication before the time, especially if the comments are sent to the Secretary, would be for parliamentary purposes, really. But in practice, comments received before in time would be sent to the department concerned, and that would obviously be taken into account, or hopefully be taken into account in finalizing the bill. Yes, and then there in the notes, note 2, we say that these rules are not really working as they should. It's also more or less formal compliance, and the purpose is to inform the public of this bill, of the subject of the bill. There also we felt that, or the group, the team felt that it might not be necessary to publish the bill as a whole. because this really is the purpose is to alert the public. So a summary might be sufficient. Then the next stage is the introduction, the formal introduction of the bill into Parliament, depending the various processes, depending on the subject matter of the bill. And then the important step is there in Parliament, it is then referred to the so-called JTM, the Joint Tagging Mechanism, that is the presiding officers of the two houses, one can say, for classification, and we will get to the tagging of the bills later on, because that classification of the bill is very important for not only for the further procedure in the House, but also for the lawfulness and the correctness, the constitutionality of the bill. I think, are you going to take over the committee stage? Yeah, the next stage is the committee stage. Yes.
The committee stage we deal with in a little more detail further on in the report. So what we're doing now is we're skipping up to, I think it's page 9. That's page 9 on my document. It could be, well, look for paragraph 7.
No, they don't.
Yep. Okay. We set out there what is the usual chain of events that transpire in a committee once a bill is before the committee. And essentially, you could divide the phases into about four phases. The first would be your briefing phase. Now, remember, this is a bill that is coming usually from the executive. We're not dealing with other bills at this stage. So we're dealing with the most usual scenario. It's coming from the executive. The subject matter is usually introduced to the committee either by the political head as the minister or perhaps a DG or a deputy DG. So the first phase would incorporate an informal discussion on the subject of the bill and the committee sitting as a whole just discussing the subject matter. Preliminary views will obviously emanate from that discussion. The second step in the briefing phase would be a clause-by-clause briefing by the official of the department. This enables a more detailed understanding of every clause of the bill and perhaps an identification already up front as to where possible difficulties would lie in terms of processing. You would then go on to what I would call the public discourse phase. And here, basically, you would have the procedure of invitations to the general public to make comments. Now, we deal with this aspect of it in some detail when we get to the public participation process. But the actual mechanism for inviting people to make comments has been a subject of much discussion. Then you would be in receipt of submissions, written submissions, as well as people requesting to come perhaps to the committee to engage the committee. And then the last step in this public discourse phase would be the consideration by the committee of those inputs that you would have received. When we sat down and we looked at the committee procedure, we discussed the one important aspect, which is that there should be a formal closure of the public participation process before the portfolio committee or select committee moves on to the deliberative process. And this became more and more important because of the challenges on the issue of public participation. So oftentimes what would happen is that there would be no record that a committee actually did engage in the public participation process. There would be no record that having received submissions that the committee actually engaged those submissions. So in other words, wanting to receive submissions, but did the committee actually take that additional step and say, this was received from Mr. XYZ, and this is his proposal in Clause 5. There was no record of that. And clearly that becomes more and more important if the courts are going to be looking at that aspect being complied with. Okay? And so what we said was that at the point that we finish the briefings and you've received these inputs, there has to be a formal process whereby the committee considers these inputs and then closes that part of the process and then moves on to deliberations, taking what you can draw from the public participation process into the next process, but then that becomes a deliberative phase of processing the bill. What we also then said as a rider is that nothing prevents, because those of you who've dealt with very controversial bills will know this, that people just continue writing to you, regardless of whether you've closed or opened or whatever it is. They just continuously write to you. And we're saying nothing prevents you as the committee from receiving those submissions that come even after the closure of the public participation process formally in your committee. Now, obviously, those closure dates and the time allocated for public participation must be reasonable. But when you get to the closure, and assuming you get new submissions all the time, nothing stops you as the chairperson of the committee from distributing those written submissions to members of your portfolio committee and members individually during the deliberative process can pick up on any issues that are new that may have come in those submissions during the deliberative process. So there is nothing preventing you from receiving those submissions regardless. In the deliberative phase, you then start looking at, as I say, drawing from those submissions what you can and drafting any amendments if there are those. This is usually informed by both public participation as well as by committee research. So there may have been areas that you would want specific research to be done on, particularly when it comes to a comparative study, how do other democracies having these rights deal with those issues. So obviously the deliberative phase is informed by that kind of research as well. So the deliberative and drafting phase can go hand in hand. And then you have your last phase, which is your adoption procedure, which is which starts from paragraph sub-E there. Now, how does that happen? You've now got your bill, you've got your amendment. What do you do? The formal procedure is that there is what we call the adoption of a motion of desirability, or a motion to accept the principle of and the need for legislation. And it was our feeling that this really has no purpose. One would assume that you've gone through all of those processes that you think that, you know, this bill is valuable and that it, there is some desirability in having it. The next would be the formal consideration of the bill and that each clause is formally put, as well as each and every amendment that the committee would have proposed. And each clause is then decided upon by a voting procedure in the committee. Once each clause has been approved and you've gotten to the absolute last clause, we felt that at this stage, where applicable, it should be followed by a motion for the committee to agree to the bill as amended. So where you've made amendments, you don't just agree to the bill, but you agree to the bill as amended, formally in your committee. Which would mean that the bill with the amendments, in other words, your B version, would have to serve before members when you adopt that bill. We have found, and I'll get to this later, maybe I should just deal with it now. It is always the committee's responsibility to ensure that the final product, so assuming you have a bill, you've made, there have been suggestions of amendments, you've given instructions to the drafter, the drafting team or the drafter to make those amendments, and they produce those amendments sort of piecemeal on different pieces of paper as you're proceeding with the deliberation. It doesn't necessarily mean that somehow those things are going to be constructed into a B bill by themselves. We've had an occasion where in the Children's Amendment Bill in 2006, the bill wasn't ready to go to the National Assembly, or the bill that went to the National Assembly didn't have the amendments of the Portfolio Committee. And the reason for that is they did not have that final version, that B version, serving before them when they voted those amendments. They voted the amendments outside of that formal bill. So we make the proposal that it should only, the committee should only pass a bill with amendments if that bill is before it, and it is voted clause by clause, and then we adopt the motion to adopt the amended bill. Of course, the next stage is the consideration and adoption of the committee's report and recommending passing or rejection of the bill. Sometimes you have a more substantive report explaining some of your amendments, but in essence, there will always be a report adopting or rejecting the bill. In the case of Section 76 bill before the NCOP, of course, you have a slightly different process in that the committee stage involves the receiving of the mandate from the provincial legislature. So in that case, because it's a 76 bill, which is, remember, those are the ones that we're dealing with, the matters in Schedule 4, which are the concurrent powers. And there, clearly, the NCOP has a slightly different procedure, and there the NCOP would vote per province and not per member. So each province will give a mandate to a delegate, and that comes to the committee to say, this is what my province's mandate is. In the case where there's a disagreement between the two houses, you would know that there is a mediation process that can then be institutionalized. Basically, the committee of each of the houses may recommend a bill, and remember, it's a recommendation to the House. Just because a committee has passed a bill through the committee doesn't mean that that House, whether it's the National Assembly or the NCOP, has passed the bill. So it has to go to the House, and it's a recommendation. That's why you have a report recommending adoption or otherwise of the bill to the House. Depending on the nature of the bill, you could also have a completely redrafted bill. So, for instance, when a bill was tabled by the name of Open Democracy Bill, the committee at that stage changed it completely into, and even changed the title of the bill into the Promotion of Access to Information Bill. So, once it's processed through the committee, you have either a bill without amendments, a bill with amendments, or a completely redrafted bill. Or, of course, a rejection of the bill. So that's really the committee stage.
Thank you. If we could just formally go back to page 5, please, just to finish the process, or the steps in the legislative process. So Mr. Chairman has now dealt with the committee stage, and then from the committee, the bill would then go for its plenary stage in the first house, placed on the order paper, and if it's accepted by the House, it goes to the second House. In the other House, there is also first a committee stage, and then if it's agreed to, then the bill is sent to the President for assent. I won't try to go into the different permutations of what could possibly happen if it's a Section 76 or 75 bill and there are amendments proposed by the other House or made by the other House. That will take us the rest of the day. But for our purposes now, it is sufficient to say that there is a committee stage in each House and then a plenary stage in each House. And if the bill is agreed to by both Houses, that is necessary for principle, unless matters like the mediation committee comes into place where the National Assembly has a two-thirds majority could override. But normally a bill once accepted, once passed by both houses, would go to the President for assent, and the bill once it is assented to by the President, then it's signed, it must be published in the Government Gazette, and at that stage it changes from a bill and it becomes an act. An act of Parliament.
Perhaps we should just go through the recommendations that we make with regard to this, and then we open up for questions on this part.
Yes.
I don't know, Anton, if you want to take us through the recommendations.
Thank you. Yes, the recommendations we make regarding the legislative process is that there should be substantial engagement between Parliament and the Executive on the pre-introduction processes, because as we indicated, that's not working well in practice. That's now the Rule 159 and the pre-publication, etc. Since the purpose of Joint Rule 159 is to alert Parliament about the imminent bill, it's recommended that rule should only require the long title of the draft bill or a summary of its objectives to be sent. It's not necessary to send the whole bill at that stage. And since the purpose, and number C, since the purpose of the notices, publication in the Government Gazette of Rules, NA Rule 241 and the NCRP rule, is to inform the public of the imminent introduction of the bill, consideration should be given to publishing only the long title or a summary of the objectives. Publication of the bill itself could follow at a later stage. That would be necessary for purposes of public engagement, but depending again on the subject matter of the bill. Those were our recommendations on this part.
In regard to the committee processes, the procedures in the committee, we just make a few recommendations there as well. Firstly, that the stages that I've spoken to be spelt out in the rules and elaborated in a handbook, which we propose later on in the report, so that we have a book that is here for all time. It's part of building this institution, so that when chairpersons leave their office, there's some kind of institutional memory around some of these processes that, and that would concretize into practice and evolve into what we call parliamentary law. We say that as I mentioned, the motion of adoption or the motion of desirability doesn't serve any purpose and should be scrapped. Then we say that in view of the practices, there are a range of practices really that have developed between, you know, depending on who the chairperson is of a particular portfolio committee. And in view of the different practices concerning public involvement in the process of passing legislation, it's become quite important, as I said in the input, to to formally end the public participation process in that process as you're going through that bill and to start your deliberative process so that there is record of the fact that the committee has in fact engaged with submissions from stakeholders and the general public. Lastly, we say that the rules should provide that the final version of the bill, i.e., the amended version or the version going to the House for passing, must be before the committee when it votes for or against the bill. So those are the recommendations which I think flow naturally from our inputs as well. I think at this stage I'm going to ask JJ if he has anything to add, because JJ served on that task team as well.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, maybe just to add things that are not here that I thought about later. But I think maybe a gap in the document, and maybe it doesn't belong in the document, but it should be covered elsewhere, would be the issue of the parliamentary, I suppose you could put more administrative processes involving the Leader of Government business and timescales. So, for example, and I don't know how much of this filters down to the chairs, but basically, Parliament requires from the executive a list of bills to be introduced, which usually comes in after the cabinet and khutla. That list is for the coming year. It gives approximate dates when a bill will come to cabinet. It's unfortunately not particularly reliable because the capacity of departments to keep to time scales that they themselves set are limited. I don't know if chairs get that. Then the presiding officers set deadlines for the executive, and there would usually be two deadlines a year. The deadline would be basically introduce your bill by this particular date, and we will ensure that it's passed by Parliament, by both Houses of Parliament, before the end of the first session or before the end of the year. Now, again, I don't know if chairs are aware of those dates. And then there's an internal date of when bills have to be passed by the National Assembly to give the NCOP sufficient time. So I think that there's maybe a need for the inclusion of that. I think there is still a rule, Anton could confirm it, that technically if you don't meet your time span, technically the bills that haven't been finalized within that period can get put onto the order paper for discussion. Obviously, some bills all bills are not the same. Some bills are complex, have a number of issues that have to be looked at, and can't be met within the time frames. But the more pedestrian bills, there's no reason why they shouldn't be. Otherwise, just there's no sort of passage of legislation. The other aspect is that there's often a problem, and again, it's not dealt with, and this maybe maybe it could have been dealt with by the document, that you get the sense from some committees that a bill will get introduced, the committee will have a hearing, and only when they have, will have a briefing on the bill, and only when they've had the briefing will they start thinking about public participation. So you'll see on committee reports that there's a briefing on a particular date, and then 2 months later, there are public hearings. Now, there's no reason why, because of the time issues, the two should be really conducted at the same time, that as soon as chairs know the bill is coming, that they can then start preparing for asking for public comment. So I just think those areas, Chair, maybe it doesn't belong in this paper, maybe it's something more for the House Chair Committees for OBID, but those should maybe be looked at, because I'm not sure if chairs and committees are even aware of these administrative pressures on them. The other point was, and again, it's maybe just to raise it, it probably doesn't belong here, but it is to deal with legislation in committees. The whole, and again, maybe more directed at OBID, the issue of the appointment of when committees deal with legislation and they deal with issues relating to the appointment of members of commissions or officials, there's no common practice. So yesterday in the NA with this independent police investigating directorates. I don't know, Cindy's not here, but I don't know how many people have read the bill. But it provides that, that if the, when the minister appoints the head of that directorate, that the relevant committees of parliament must agree. So in other words, the minister must send the name to the police portfolio committee and the NCOP equivalent, and they must agree to it. Now usually committees don't have powers on their own. Those powers are usually done by the House. So I think that's the problem, in fact, with the bill. But I think what I'm raising is that the whole issue of appointments should be standardized. You will have some structures. I mean, not all structures are the same. The Chapter 9s have are accountable theoretically to the National Assembly, not to, to the executive. But other, these other advisory bodies, you'll find some committees writing into legislation that, that they must advertise, they must approve, or they must follow the process. I think ICASA is lists of names sent to the minister, and they must pick one, and then they send it back. I'm really just saying, Chair, Ovid, that I think that that's something to be looked at. And I think the other aspect to be looked at would also be regulations. Some committees saying they must approve regulations before they come into effect. Others saying they must just be tabled. What criteria apply? What guidance is given to committees on that? So I just think those are two other areas that, that, that maybe could be looked at a later point, but I think are quite important as part of the process.
Thank you. Yes, I think Mr. Jeffries raised a few very pertinent points, and whether it should be added to this document or not, I think for parliamentary purposes it would be important to deal with the, with that. Maybe if I could start with the last aspect, that's my job for the weekend to come, because I'm assisting Gauteng legislature. They are a bit upfront in that regard, because they already have a law on the scrutiny of subordinate legislation, and they want to affect some amendments to that now. But certainly it is necessary that that is a very important part of the oversight of Parliament to scrutinize its that part of its lawmaking powers that it has delegated to the executive, and I'm afraid in practice very little about that happens. And as Mr. Jeffries has pointed out, there are various procedures, and it differs from act, because there are some acts that do require parliamentary approval, but there is not a uniform procedure. As far as the deadlines, etc., concerned. I think that, yes, that should be covered, but that is typically something that would be covered in the handbook. I have got a copy of the Australian handbook here, and that is typically something that is dealt with there in the handbook. I thank you. I think that's sufficient.
I think the point to remember in this regard also is that all of these processes are really in-house arrangements to enable an efficiency of process. And if we're going to start importing a lot of those into our rules proper, they become matters over which the judiciary can exercise review. So you would want there to be that flexibility so that if, for example, in 3 or 5 parliaments' time, people want to work differently, that there's that flexibility to remove things and so on and to start a new practice. So you don't want to import those into what is almost called parliamentary law. Those are practices, and that's why we suggest the handbook, which is quite an important tool. And we'll actually go through the kinds of examples that other countries have got in terms of handbooks and the kind of detailed information that contains. And it's easy then to change a handbook. It's not so easy to change a rule, because there's a whole constitutional process that has to work its way through. Comedian, let's just
thank you very much. I just wanted to check whether you have considered scoping what is called public participation. Thank you.
Just a follow-up on that particular issue of public participation. Probably we're in a democracy that is both representative democracy and also participatory democracy. And then I think the balance element of it ought to be something, because submissions get given, people go to public hearings, and then I think you spoke well in terms of, are we considering all those issues? Is there a record of consideration that indeed we did look at the issues, but we didn't agree with you? And using the representative mandate that you have elected us, therefore we could put this way. So that there's a record, because without a record, obviously, that's why the council can't even do that. But what should be this balance? At what point do you say the people have spoken, and therefore are listening to the people on this issue? And then the classical example I like to do is the civil union. Yeah. The people spoke this way, and then Parliament went this way. And then the participatory democracy was saying no to it, but the representative democracy says, you gave us mandate when you elected us, therefore we are deciding this way.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to find out if ministers and deputy ministers are apprised of these processes and procedures. There was a requirement before by DORA that before a legislation is, or a bill is introduced, when it's introduced, not before, it must be accompanied by a costing of that bill. What I want to know, is that still applicable? If so, the procedures, I know it's not your task, but I think perhaps if we can be apprised of the processes and the procedures to be followed when processing such. Because, you know, it's been a bit difficult to really process that part of a bill, because the reason behind that was because most bills are passed and enacted, but then they become part of the furniture, mainly because they do not have money to be processed. The other issue that I wanted to find out is around the timeline. You said earlier on that there should be stipulated timelines in terms of submission, but then the committee can continue receiving submissions, written submissions and so on, for the purposes of ensuring that you have records. Because at some stage you could be asked whether you have indeed considered proposals or recommendations from the public or what. What I want to find out regarding that is you talked something about reasonable time. People should be given reasonable time. I just want to understand what would be reasonable time even after you have already put some timelines and those timelines have lapsed. And then the last one is around the amendment during the committee process. Who is responsible to ensure that those amendments are included? What I mean is that the bill has been introduced by a department. It's now at the committee stage, wherein the committee is deliberating upon that bill. The amendments, as you have clearly stipulated here, but to ensure that those amendments are included, and they're checked as to whether they meet the requirements of the committee. Who is responsible for that? Is it the legal section within? Is it the department itself, where it should go? And because mind you, that process of briefing between yourself and the department is already lapsed. So I just want clarity. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure. I've got four questions. The first one relates to this document. Throughout, I was searching for this requirement, but it's not there. That which requires the committee considering a bill to consult with other committees in relation to the impact this bill may have on the work of those committees or the constituencies or relevant to that committees or stakeholders affected by the bill that is being considered. There's no requirement to that effect. In our committee, we have got into contact with this kind of requirement without any rule requiring us to deal with it. So if it is a requirement, why not in this? The second one, this document relates to constitutional court safekeeping. How does an act get to be called unconstitutional if there's nowhere where an act is ratified as constitutional? Why is it referred to the constitutional court only for safekeeping? Why is it left to the public to challenge that act through the constitutional court as to whether it's constitutional or not, and yet it has been referred to the constitutional court for safekeeping? Why would they keep a law which may potentially be unconstitutional? The second one refers to what Comrade has read. There's nowhere in the rules that we have seen where it says public participation requirement to be met at this. There's no outline. And yet many bills become act or fall or stand on the basis that there was no public participation. There's a bill, there's an act now which is potentially going to be become unconstitutional because the public has not been consulted. The Traditional Governance and Framework Act, which incorporates aspects of the act that have been repealed. And I'm not sure why Parliament would not have any requirement to be fulfilled on public participation. The last one relates to time frames from a different angle. When an act is set to be valid until a particular date, pending the passing of another act, which must fill a vacuum or whatever, which will then repeal that one for the other one to take over. Whose responsibility is that? Because when Parliament makes that ruling, it is not them who must bring another bill to the House. It is the executive. So how do you set those time frames without power to deal with that aspect?
Can I take the floor, sir? Thank you. But just mine is just a comment, really. First, regarding the stages in that paragraph titled Initiating Development and Cabinet Approval. It's obvious that does not capture all the sources from which legislation emanates. Of course, it's the Constitution. It's the white paper that would contain the policy of that particular department, and even the manifesto, especially of the party that is ruling. But at the same time, there are private members' bills I would have thought you would have wanted to enlighten us as to how they are supposed to be dealt with and introduced and so on. And regarding the question of the motion of desirability, I must have been conducting our business wrongly while I was chairing a committee that dealt with the legislation, because what happened, which we thought was logical, was that where the bill was introduced informally by the department of the committee, and then we deliberated we to understand the purpose for which it has been introduced, what exactly, where does it emanate? Is it from the constitution, from the manifesto, from the freedom charter, or from the white paper? Then, obviously, then we would decide whether or not it's desirable for us to proceed with that bill, because indeed there's validity for its introduction. Theoretically, it meant that we could reject it at that stage and say, no, there's no desirability of such a bill because it does not conform with any of these documents I'm talking about. And also, at that stage, that's when we decide, when we're in a position to determine whether there's a need for the public to be consulted or not. Because the department would have indicated to us that the relevant stakeholders have been properly consulted and they are in agreement in general with the bill. In such instances, therefore, we would obviously decide that it's not necessary for the public to be invited. Now, on the question of the question of motion of desirability, therefore, it seems if it were to follow that route, it would still be necessary. But if it is considered only after everything has been done, including public participation, then it doesn't make sense. It should therefore be done away with. On the question of public participation again, where people are given the opportunity to make comments on the bill, then indeed there should be a time frame by which such submissions may not be entertained. Because if we allow the public to continue to make submissions even while we are deliberating now on the bill together with the submissions made, then that would be unfair on those who are not in a position to have representatives sitting in parliament in committee listening and now and again submitting their own things while others out there are not getting that opportunity because of lack of means. So there should indeed therefore be a cut of time by which this, but of course there should be exceptional instances, like where somebody out there in the countryside suddenly hears over the radio that there's a bill that talks about this and this person for some reason was not in a position to hear that there was this opportunity. So in such instances, I'm sure there should be that kind of exception. Thank you, Shabbos.
Thank you very much, Shabbos. I would like to touch some few issues. I think let me start on the participatory and the representative democracy. I just want to check, where do you draw the line between these two as the deciding, whoever was deciding? Because I think we need to have some criteria of some sort, because it could not be open for if it suits you, because there are different issues that come before the for parliament. So when it suits you, you take the representative decision, and then when it suits you, you take the participatory. It must be. I think there has to be some sort of criteria or specifics. And then the second point is around the pre-processes or substantial engagement between parliament and executive. I think that recommendation, I would fully support that recommendation, because mostly you will find that if that process did not take up, you will find that when the committee deals with the legislation, it will discover that really we can hang on this legislation for some various reasons. So, but if that process was fully taken up, at least everything would be threshed out, and then it will be easier to process the legislation. And excuse me, on the issue of public submissions, I don't think there can be so disruptions that can be expected so far, because if that process, even the bill was publicized to the public and the committee begins to engage with the public, as Mapela has mentioned earlier on, I think we can't experience more challenges. And then the other issue on the costing that was raised by Honorable Coleman. There is a challenge that you will find that even the department itself, they bring the legislation before Parliament, yet they are not ready or they do not have the capacity to implement the legislation itself. So I think those are the issues. If those processes, that those preliminary processes are engaged in, they will help Parliament as well as executive to address those issues before the legislation, the processes is up and at least have been checked out. Lastly, the issue of regulations. I think it is very much important that portfolio committees, those regulations must be brought before the portfolio committees, because you'll find that the devil of the legislation lies on those regulations. The committee will be assured that no, we have dealt with the legislation, is satisfied. Hey, when the legislation comes to implementation on the ground, which animal is this one now? And then they will tell you that it's the regulations. So I think this thing must be a practice. It must be regulated to Parliament that at least these regulations must come through the process of Parliament, so that you start with the dealing with legislation. So it underlines really the challenge to the portfolio committee. Let's try and make it a point that the processes are charged out, the preliminary process, so that legislation 16th of September.
Anyone who wants to interpret the Zulu part of the input?
Because if you open up, you would really open your affairs, open Parliament up to all kind of litigation, because there's no closure. Normally, maybe the issue that needs Parliament put improve on is communication. Because all you see Parliament does, the notices come out from the Sunday's papers, the so-called national papers. But the other people that were referred to here in the, who do not have to this access. How do they know about the closure? How do they know about how do they know that they could participate here? Should we be going to radios and what all kinds of languages so that when there's closure, it's clear to everyone that it is open now, there will be a time for closing. But you can't open it, otherwise the committee would never be able to operate if it remains open all the time and it can be subject to all kinds of challenges. But the question that I also wanted to raise, Chair, is around the issue of this handbook that was mentioned here. If we say a certain item should not necessarily be on the rules, it should be on the handbook. It's disturbing. I suppose that the handbook is there just as a guideline for committees. Here is the handbook, then committees can operate like this. But there's nothing, but if it's in the rule, it's a rule, everybody knows that it's a rule whatever procedure is there in the making of law. I think it's better because everybody can be referred to a rule. But a handbook is something that, it's a gentleman's agreement. I'm not being sexist. I know only gentlemen. It's a gentleman's agreement. It's like a gentleman's agreement. But if it's in the rules, everybody knows what the rule is. There's no beating about the bush. I suspect that those things that need to be in the rules should be in the rules. Okay. You want to introduce something new now. Just the last comment I would like to make, Chair, is around the joint tagging mechanism. There has been legislation where, for instance, it's tagged Section 75, and maybe the other house feels that this Section 75 was not right. But what is the role of the committee? If the committee is off, for instance, the view that the taking was not what we call the correct, it was not correctly taken, maybe could have been Section 76. Does the committee really have a role in that? Thank you. Just another handbook thing is water, you know, here. There's no water. I'm not sure who's responsible.
Yeah, let me also thank the presenters because it helps us to actually not only understand but in a sense implement some of the issues that we are faced with even now. Just around public participation, I think we shouldn't even have an ability to debate the issue of should we or shouldn't we or how minimalistic or how big it should be. What I've picked up more and more is departments would raise the issue of minimalistic technical changes. Now, how minimalistic is those changes really? You know, you can get it as elementary as just changing words in definitions, but at times it does have knock-on effects. And therefore, if you actually read some of the draft bills that would be in front of you, and read that in conjunction with other legislation, then you start seeing some, you get a little bit more deeper understanding of that it is then not as minimalistic as initially in that informal process
being presented by a department. So I would be cautious that we would take a decision on if we should, even if it's technical, very basic technical legislative changes to go for if we or if we should not. I rather would want to suggest that we have to have public participation, even if it's at the level of minimal changes. But then clearly with time frames, and those time frames normally would be an upfront process. So if there's the intention to go out on that process of the drafting of the bill, then in that advertisement, in the process, in the programming, I think if one are able to put those things in there, then you actually don't need to have an open-ended process on some of the issues that we've just heard. You spelled it out clearly. In the event where substantial issues are then being raised, where you then obviously have to go through further processing, that would be picked up in that time frame. So that would be my suggestion around the public participation and the debates that we've just heard. It seems to me all the more that the issue of public participation will, as our democracy mature, that will all the more be an issue in society. And hence, therefore, it's best to articulate that in our process and rather than to be silent on it and deal with it as things come along.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is also around public participation, let alone that the Honourable Member has raised that it does not appear in the rules. But we need to check whether the procedures of Parliament itself or the process that we use allow us to engage with public participation, especially with regard to the submissions that are brought before us. I'm not very comfortable when we say if the committee considers it necessary. The fact that that particular group or stakeholder has made those submissions, to me, it's done because they render it necessary. So I don't think it's correct for us as a committee to then say or think, no, it's not necessary, therefore we are not going to, you know, engage with that. And another issue that I never ever understood is the fact that, of course, the bill is proposed wherever it's proposed, usually at the department level. But I don't think it's correct that the committee would deal with the bill from its introduction to the end without the particular minister that is involved ever appearing before the committee. In all the years, I've never seen it done. Usually we put all our trust just to the officials and it ends there. And I don't think it doesn't look correct to me. Perhaps at some stage we should have that particular minister coming before the committee and engaging with us on some of the issues. Thanks.
Comet Tula has a question. Okay. And Comet, can we just begin a process whereby we try and answer some of these questions, but to also just say that we said we would finish by 10:30, it's now 25:02, so we'll take the answers and then we will separately session another opportunity for you, and we'll go through exactly the same stuff, but in addition those other things as well. But I think it's been worthwhile in any case, because as you can hear from the comments, what we thought was old hat is actually stuff that we grapple with every day in a new context, and it creates challenges in a new context all the time. So it's a very fluid environment that we're working in. And so it's always good to relook at the stuff. And just by by people engaging with us now already, you know, one sees that, oh, there are issues here as opposed to there and so on. What I wanted to say was, and I'm going to ask Anton to answer most of the questions, but may I just take this opportunity and say, look, on the issue of public participation, the only reason we raise it here is because it's part of the committee procedure, right? And there is a more substantive discussion in this booklet on the issue of public participation. We cannot, without dealing with some of the pronouncements by the courts, deal with that issue now, simply because we'll be dealing with it in a kind of a vacuum, and the context is not going to work very well. And that's probably going to take me half an hour to explain and deal with those issues that people have been raising around public participation. But suffice to say this, firstly, on the issue of whether or not the rules have this notion of public participation in them and provide guidance, the truth of the matter is that we do not have a choice anymore as Parliament on this matter. The courts have decided for us. And so to say that the rules are silent and so therefore doesn't give us any direction is incorrect, because law is made two ways, by Parliament and politicians, we're talking about delegated legislation as well, but also by court pronouncements. And the courts have pronounced on this matter. Question is, what are those parameters? What have they said? What haven't they said? And where are the spaces for us as Parliament to retake that environment? So that's a more substantive discussion that I want us to have. The one issue they have not dealt with Comet Ovid, which is very interesting, and one would have thought that they would deal with, is precisely the issue that you raise around representative democracy and participatory democracy, because that seems to me to be the crux of how one would even initiate a discussion going forward, you know? And yet, apart from the minority judgment, which also doesn't deal with it, but just says, look, you guys are wrong, it just doesn't deal with it. And so, and partly the fault has been ours, because we have had these practices, and people have gone on road shows with the smallest provocation, frankly, whether it's a technical bill or, you know, people have gone on road shows to provinces and so on. And so we're actually upping the bar for those committees who have more legislation. Now, I'll give you an example. The Justice Committee constantly has very, very controversial legislation before it. It cannot, firstly, in terms of the committee budget, even afford to go to every province on every bill. It would just be, they'll be traveling for 5 years. And yet, when we have the civil unions, which also is quite controversial, that committee ups and goes to every single locality where there's some kind of conservative leadership so that there is maximum public participation. The issue is, if you have legislation in the one committee, let's say around the sexual offenses, which was very problematic for us because we had huge interest groups wanting to legalize prostitution. Now, if they had challenged that thing on the basis that we did not take that hugely controversial bill to every single province, as did the Home Affairs Committee, they would have won. Why? Because we had set the bar high for ourselves. And we simply could not have done that because, unlike Home Affairs, we had about 20 bills that year to process, most of which were very controversial, whereas they had one. So it's the synergy also that we have to start talking about amongst ourselves as colleagues, because what you do affects me, and what I do affects you. And so that is very much the attitude of the courts. They're saying it's part of the adopted practice and therefore it has become what is called parliamentary law. But we'll deal with that issue of public participation, I suggest, in that longer session, because it will take us quite a while to deal with all of the issues. I'm going to hand over to Anton to answer some of the questions, and I'll take whatever he's got left.
Thank you, Madam. Yes, I'm not sure whether I have all the questions, but maybe I should start off by saying yes, these were some very interesting questions, and it shows how necessary this type of engagement is, and also how necessary this type of exercise is to rethink and go over, review the whole legislative process. But what is quite evident is that we would need a very long workshop, maybe a few days, Bosparat or so and so, to go through these issues. The document that was prepared by the task team is in the form of a summary, and I agree entirely that there are many other things that could possibly have been covered here, but I always say that's why I hate summaries, especially, you know, these memorandums attached to bills and so on. These things are never accurate, let's say very rarely accurate that you can go on them. So this is, you know, if we had to write everything about the legislative process and so on, it would have been a very comprehensive document. So that is why some issues have not been covered, but those members who did mention aspects that should have been covered here or that could have been covered, certainly I agree with that. And maybe I could also say regarding the handbook versus the rules or the rules, yes. I agree that if any matter is in the line of a for example, an instruction to a committee or a prescript that should be followed, yes, that should be in the rules if that is necessary. But what we have in mind with the handbook is that there should be, it's really got to do with the whole process. How even from the embryo stages of a bill right up to the end, and that would also involve the process, for example, in the executive. And I mean, it's not for Parliament to prescribe either by its rules or otherwise how the executive should go about its business. If Parliament wants to bind the executive in any way, then it must make a law. It can make a law, obviously. So what we have in mind with the handbook is that it should stipulate the roles of the various stakeholders, the procedures in the legislative process, and the you know, there could be many things could be covered, and that is why we say that it should be really a joint exercise, a joint initiative between Parliament and the executive, this type of handbook. Yes, there was a question about the ministers, whether they know about these procedures and or should know, maybe, and that reminded me of quite an embarrassing situation in which I was in when I was the chief legal advisor here. Mrs. Pandor, when she used to be the chairperson of the NCLP, she arranged a meeting of ministers to be... I can't remember even what the subject was, but it had something to do with parliamentary procedure and the interaction between ministers and parliament and so on. And she asked me to do a presentation there, and I had just started to explain the sort of basic stuff, which I say is basic stuff for people who know. And when one of the ministers asked Mrs. Pandor, "Do we have to listen to this?" So, yes, I think it's necessary that there should be coordination between the executive and Parliament. And that is one of the reasons why there are parliamentary councillors, for instance, assisting the executive in this regard. And as far as the appearance of ministers before committees are concerned, yes, that is something that is... what shall I say, a very sensitive issue, especially in some committees and some ministers. Seems to me, I can only go by newspaper reports nowadays, of course. But whether a minister should appear on every bill, I really don't think it's necessary. But if a committee really feels that a minister is that it is necessary to have the minister present to explain something or to explain government policy or whatever, then obviously it's free, it's the committee is free to do so. That is part and parcel. It's spelled out not only in the rules, it's also spelled out in the constitution. But normally that would be in exceptional cases. Yes, there was the question about the Constitutional Court and the sending of the safekeeping of bills. There's only one or two provisions in the Constitution that provide for the Constitutional Court to give upfront verdicts about the constitutionality of bills. And the one is where the president feels that the bill is not constitutional, then the president can refer it to the Constitutional Court after first having sent it back to Parliament. But if that is not resolved, there have been a few cases like that. Then also members of the National Assembly can apply to the Constitutional Court to have to decide whether or not a bill is constitutional. That is Section 80 of the Constitution. But apart from that, there is no provision, and the court will not be able to give upfront an indication of constitutionality. So unfortunately, there one has to go through the ordinary court processes. What else? Yes. I think you've dealt, madam, with the public participation issues. Yes, we would need a separate session on that. You will see right at the end there's quite pages of recommendations that we make, or the task team made, about as far as the public participation process is concerned. Let me just see what else. Yes, I've mentioned about what should not be here. Obviously, one could add, as far as the initiation is concerned, things like white papers, green papers, members' bills. I don't know whether at the time I was here we were preparing a manual on members' bills. I'm not sure whether that ever saw the light. Public participation, what should be in the rules of JTM. Yes, and then the question of the JTM was raised. We probably won't have time to get to tagging today. The JTM, as you would know, that is the body in Parliament responsible for classification of bills for parliamentary procedure. And that is the part of this document which would need to be rewritten to some extent. If I could, shall I just briefly refer to that? Yeah. We sort of cover ourselves to some extent there, that we say that the courts haven't given guidance, but there is a case before the court, a Tongwane case now, and the court has now spoken in that regard, the court has come to the conclusion that was in a judgment delivered in April. It was only published now in March in the law reports, that the judgment that the case the bill was wrongly classified and the bill is therefore unconstitutional. That is it's got serious consequences, obviously, for the tagging of bills. And but if I could just summarize then, as far as tagging is concerned, what the Constitutional Court said is there on page 17, middle of the page, that whenever provisions of a bill in substantial measure fall within the functional areas of Schedule 2, it must be dealt with under Section 76. That's really, in the end, what it boils down. It's not so far from the test that we proposed in the document, and that the JTM has followed, the sort of pith and substance, that one must look at the pith and substance, the subject matter of a bill. But the court has said that one should distinguish between classifying a bill for purposes of tagging, that is in the parliamentary process, and classifying a bill for purposes of legislative competence. But that's now getting too involved. Oh yes, but the question was really whether the committee could go back to the JTM, or what should the committee just accept the classification? And there is provision in the rules that the committee, I'm not sure whether there's a specific, the committee can consult the JTM if it amends the bill and it thinks it might affect the classification, but I think that it could be accepted as normal practice that if there is a disagreement about in the committee about the classification, or if the committee doesn't agree with the JTM, to consult the JTM and to ask the JTM to reconsider. There is provision in the joint rules that the JTM can reclassify. And if somebody else comes up with an idea that it should be differently classified, then it should be done. Rather that the classification be changed in the parliamentary process and that the correct procedure be followed, than for following the wrong procedure and having it declared unconstitutional. Thank you, madam. I think that is fine.
Just on that issue, there is precedent for committees having approached the JTM to relook at the tagging and so on. In fact, there was occasion where once the bill was passed, in the sexual offences bill, which was essentially a 75 bill because it pertained to justice and the codification of crime related to sexual offences. It was tagged 75. The committee processed the legislation, and as I mentioned before, it was rather controversial because it ranged from huge interest groups such on HIV/AIDS, for example, right through to prostitution kind of thing. And one of the things that the committee then did was that it inserted a clause that said that when a rape victim presents herself, usually it's a herself, to a police station, there should be a list of local clinics there where the person can go and get the kind of treatment, the cocktail of treatments, the PEP treatment within 72 hours. And that was a huge, I mean, there's a whole background to that as well. But that clause was then attacked by SWET, and SWET made a representation. Literally, we were on the floor of the House wanting to pass the bill when the bill was withdrawn from the order paper, on the ground that SWET had made a representation to the Speaker, and the Speaker had then withdrawn the bill because they then said this bill ought to have been classified 76 and therefore there's a wrong procedure, because they were unhappy about the fact that we didn't legalize prostitution, of course. And the committee then substantively dealt with the issue of tagging, and in fact it might be a very useful reference document to distribute to chairpersons, because it deals with the background of tagging. It's quite a thick report, but it will give you, if you're really interested in knowing what tagging is about and what it isn't about, that goes to the very heart of, remember, our constitutional negotiating process, where we had said there are certain powers that are delineated for provinces, certain that are concurrent, and certain that are national. And through tagging, you can actually upset that balance. In fact, you'll see in our document here, when you read the issue of tagging, there certain academics are saying that every single bill should be a 76 bill, and that it should be an exception to have a 75 bill. So there are huge implications politically and constitutionally with regard to tagging. And you've seen now that the court can actually say, ex post facto, that this bill is wrongly tagged, and so therefore it's unconstitutional, which is a huge problem for us as legislators. So there we will need to have some very definite frameworks and very definite practices that we will need to stand. And I think the chairs are going to be very, very instrumental in getting us to that point as Parliament. But we'll deal with that subject in some detail when we have that workshop. The issue of technical bills going through the public participation process, Comrade Marius, I think the courts have specifically said, and this is something that we must also try, there they close the gap a little bit in favor of Parliament, and they say, well, it's obviously technical. You don't need to embark on public participation. But again, as you point out, there's technical and there's technical. And so clearly there would need to be some judgment exercised by the chairperson under those circumstances. And as long as it's reasonable, the court will not necessarily declare that to be inappropriate and so on. As far as acts and regulations are concerned, the fact that we give a lot of our powers away as far as delegated legislation, there are very definite things and instrumentalities as chairs that we should be discussing amongst ourselves and some good practices. I know that when we dealt with legislation in the justice bill, and particularly in the ones where we thought there was going to be problems with implementation, we said that those regulations, before they get published, must be adopted by Parliament. So in other words, ministers must draft them, bring them to Parliament. Parliament will say yes, and then only will they become law. So there are those kinds of instrumentalities that you can put in place even when you're drafting, which will assist. But of course, you can't have, you know, every single regulation coming in. So it will have to be those that you're really concerned about, those that you think are going to make or break this piece of legislation that you've prepared. And so it's really, again, a call that you would need to make. There is also a document that Comrade Mike Masuta prepared probably not even in the last parliament before around delegated legislation that has not seen the light of day. It's served numerous times, I think, on the joint rules, but we've never really resolved those issues. But it might be another reference document that you might want to circulate, mm-hmm. and people might then find use for it as and when you get to a point and a challenge arises, and then, you know, you can always consult. It's a reference document. So I think that might be very useful as well. The fact that there's no rule requiring consulting with other committees, I think the issue is twofold. The first is usually when the subject matter is plain to see. So when the bill comes and it's, let's say it's transporting school children, then it's quite obvious that it's transport and basic education. And the speaker would naturally say, when the speaker refers the bill to the committee for consideration, they will say, in consultation, the two committees have to, or with conferral. But, you know, there are two ways. You either, you know, have to sit together jointly, or you would just confer and so on. So that's the one aspect. But sometimes it's a bit obscure. So when you go open democracy, which is a kind of, you're wondering, what is that about? And yet it may be that intelligence needs to be spoken to. And in fact, that bill had an effect on every single department. So there it's really a matter where the two chairs should then take the initiative and just go ahead and do it. So there is that interplay, and it's really, again, a question that a chair would need to manage politically, really. The cost, is more of an issue of substance rather than procedure in one sense. Look, obviously they're money bills. And if a bill is obviously a money bill, then only the Minister of Finance can table such a bill, in which case Treasury will be directly involved and so on. But if we're talking about legislation that has got a costing implication, then it seems to me that this becomes an issue not so much of procedure as opposed to substantive engagement with the department on its readiness to implement. And, you know, an example comes to mind when we dealt with the child justice legislation. We'd required a costing up front, even before we saw the bill. This was done, and the time we passed the legislation, probably about 4 or 5 years later, the costing was still there, but you still have implementation problems and readiness problems. So costing is not going to sort out by itself those issues. And it's really a question of us, when implementation is a big issue for, and it's a big headache for most chairs, particularly when you're introducing something completely new, not so much when you're amending current legislation and so on. And it's really a question of us having to assess, as part of the process, I think, the state of readiness of the department in some way. So that's where your oversight and your legislation-making powers kind of intersect with each other. And no amount of procedural regulation, I'm afraid, is ever going to help you with that one. On the issue of continuing to receive inputs from the public and what is a reasonable time and so on, look, the issue is we've been basically been told what to do on this issue, right, on public participation, within a kind of gaping framework. You do not, as a chairperson, I would think, want to take the risk of rejecting a submission on the basis that it was late, because what would normally then happen is if the person feels strongly, and if you have, and you know the kind of people who come to us with inputs are usually very resourced and so on, and they have monetary interest 9 times out of 10. When you look behind it, it's monetary interest. So people are usually going to take matters to court on the slightest provocation. So it seems to me that the better route would be that, yes, we've advertised, we've had submissions coming in, we've closed that procedure, we've considered those things, we've closed the procedure. Now you want to come ex post facto and bring a submission. Question is, do we accept it, do we reject it? And our feeling as the task team is it's not going to kill you to accept it, but you don't need to in the formal process and deal with it. What you would do is you would distribute it to each and every single member of your committee, who in any case as a representative of the people can raise any issue during deliberations, including any issue in that submission. And that is the interplay between what I would call representative democracy and open democracy as such. So that would be the safest course of action, really, from our point of view. And right up to the point where voting actually happens in your committee, there's no reason then to say we're going to reject any submission that comes, because that's just looking for trouble. But we'll deal with that in a little more detail when we get to the public participation process. What is reasonable time? I usually, and it's a thumbs up really, I usually would make sure that your advert or your press statement, depending on what mechanism you're using, would give a window of opportunity for submissions for at least the minimum 2 weeks. If the processes work properly, and you got your Rule 159 notice ahead of time and you don't have your bill yet, there's absolutely no reason to say, well, you know, we're expecting it in a month, so we get 4 weeks. So it's really a question, but at the very least 2 weeks would be sufficient, because that's the kind of notifications that the courts use in their processes as well. So when you get a summons, you usually are told, you know, you've got 2 weeks to respond and so on. So that would be the kind of ballpark that I would offer to chairs, but if there's nothing in black and white that says this is a reasonable time and that is not a reasonable time. Of course, the urgency of the legislation sometimes would factor in, and the courts have made reference to urgent matters as well, in which case they would overlook certain steps that may not have been fully complied with and so on. Who's responsible to ensure amendments of bills? We took the position. Yeah, well, I can deal with it, but you can add it. Okay. So we took the position in the document that once the bill is tabled in Parliament, it becomes Parliament's responsibility. And when the speaker or the chairperson refers it to a portfolio or select committee. The responsibility for that bill lies primarily with the committee and as the chairperson, as the head of that committee. So under no circumstances, and you know, people have often asked, how is it that you use department officials to draft these bills and they're your bills and so on, you know, what about the separation of powers and all of that? And my take is, and you know, I think we as chairs do need to also sit down and have a discussion on what we mean by separation of powers, because there's so much of emphasis on the superficial notion of separation that we don't talk about the distribution of powers, and that ultimately we're all working towards one goal. So particularly when it comes to legislation, as was pointed out, we pass the legislation, it's our baby, but you know what? We pass on the baton as much as that baton was passed on to us. And that becomes a piece of legislation that has got to be actualized, that has got to be implemented, and we don't implement. In fact, that's why we oversee, you know. So if there is no cooperation there, it becomes a monstrosity of an instrument. And then what would happen is precisely the kinds of things that we've seen happening, is that the legislation then lies and nobody implements, because there's just been no engagement into the kind of things that we were talking about earlier, capability of the department to implement the budgets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So on the issue of whose responsibility is it once the baton is passed, we've taken the view that it is the chair's responsibility, and that's why we said that the amended version must serve before the committee when you vote on that bill. If there is nothing there, and if you've just got scraps of paper and so on, where the wording is nice and you've all agreed on the wording, that's not the bill. You want the B version of the bill before you vote on that bill. Otherwise, your vote's not going to get to the House. So that's our take on who's... the issue of the motion of desirability, and that's a very interesting notion that I never thought about, Comet Pasquale, and I think it requires some consideration. My only hesitation, and this would just be at the top of my head, would be that you might get... There are two issues. The first is you've got a controversial... Let's say your media tribunal. Immediately, the opposition parties will want to take on the motion of desirability and say, make a big issue out of that. So that becomes the one issue that you might... And it's not just opposition parties. It may just be posturing for all kinds of reasons, right? And then the question would be, do we engage the public on that very issue? So that becomes a bit of a problem for me. And then, of course, remember I said to you that you could also, as a committee, completely redraft a bill. Completely. It could be cheese when it starts, and it can be chalk when it ends. And I'm worried that you get to a point where the committee is so scoffed by the bill that you don't actually take the opportunity to transform it into something that is actually worthwhile and so on. If you are too focused on saying, is this desirable in this form that it is, and we're not going to think beyond that. So I'm just saying that while I think it's an interesting thing for us to, and maybe we should discuss it, and maybe we'll discuss it some more in that workshop, but I think that there may be one or two issues that you might also want to not have if you bring it up front. I think I've dealt with all of the questions that I've noted. Anton, do you want to add anything to what I've said?
Madam, if I could just add something about regarding the question as to the preparation of amendments for committees. We've dealt with that. It's on page 23 of the document, there, paragraph 41, that there isn't at the moment a uniform process for the preparation of the bills. But as you have quite rightly pointed out, the responsibility lies with the committee. It's now Parliament's bill. But I know in some provinces they have interpreted this to be, it's now our bill, we don't want your advisors to advise us here. And there's this sort of a mistrust, and I think you used a very useful word, if I might say so, and that is the distribution of powers. legislative drafting is a very, very scarce commodity in the country. And I mean, I know there in some provinces they, or it's particularly one that I know of, they have the parliamentary law advisors or their own law advisors draft the amendments and so on. And I think that it's just about impossible to do that properly, because it's easy to fit in one or two words or even a section or so, but then what about all the consequential amendments? More often than not, in the end, it's not a properly drafted product. Unless that law advisor at Parliament is an experienced drafter and has been given sufficient time to go properly through the bill to infect, well, then it can happen, but obviously it would be a replication of the job. So that is why we have made certain recommendations also in this regard. But we're not going to discuss that today, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to respond to what JJ raised earlier on Chapter 9, that the process is separate, obviously, it will not be part of this one. We the Deputy Speaker is responsible for the establishment of the unit in her office that is going to be looking at procedural processes that ought to be taking care of that environment on Chapter 9 and Chapter 10. The advisory bodies are in discussion, but we will also be looking at that. But next week, all the institutions supporting democracy will be in a meeting here in Parliament, and we'll be inviting the chairperson that associated with those Chapter 9 and 10 to be part of that discussion, because they are feeling that they are not very independent. They report to Parliament in terms of the establishment. The money gets appropriated in Parliament, but is dispensed in the executive. For them, therefore, they feel that that's not been independent, because then they have been stifled there. If you don't work closely with the executive member concerned, you get chopped with the money that has been appropriated and so forth. So we'll be developing mechanisms separately for that. And also there are these legal aspects that arises from time to time. For example, the committees will recommend names to ICASA, for example, and it's a classical example. And then one member who has been recommended by the committee, resolved by the House resolution to be a member of ICASA, was found to be conflicted. And in terms of the law, you cannot appoint that person. But at the stage of the interview, the committee did ask the person. The person says, yes, in fact, the person declared and said, I'm conflicted. And the committee said, will you be deconflicting yourself within 6 months? And the person said, yes, I will definitely. At the point of appointment, the person has not yet deconflicted himself. And the minister then comes and says, I can't appoint this person. You, Parliament, must go back to the House and resolve to remove the person then. And Parliament is known of, but the minister, you are the appointing agency. We only recommend the House resolution. And then you then must deal with the situation. The minister says, I'm not going to do it. You, Parliament, do it. So we had to find a solution. The two of us, Parliament and the minister, are now voluntarily going to court to disqualify the person. So some elements that happen at the committee level, you ought to look at the consequences at the end, be legislation, the appointment of this, because then that's where we are. So we'll then be developing such mechanisms and harmonization and the standardization so that those who are dealing with the appointment or the recommendation of appointment, shortlisting, what have you, your work within a particular format, that will then be in the handbook. The handbook elements will be quite a popular issue going forward. Thank you.
We don't have anything further. We're in your hands.
And I think that's the end of our meeting, but we'll reconvene soon after the Ramadan, because we can't do it now in respect of those chairs who are still in Ramadan. And we'll look for a date appropriately in which we'll then have an evening where we could then take from 5 until late 10 or 11 and really go substantively on the issues in a bigger number. And thank you very much for that.